Welcome to the Yoga Hour, offering insights and practices for spiritually conscious living in today's world. Here is your host, Dr. Laurel Trujillo.
Welcome to the Yoga Hour, where we talk about yoga in all its depth and breadth as a path to spiritually conscious, fulfilled living in today's world. I'm Dr. Laurel Trujillo, host and producer of the show. Today, we're going to be discussing how the ancient science of yoga can help us to improve not only our overall well-being, but particularly our heart health. Today, my guest is Susie Amendola, the author of the book we will be discussing today, The Centered Heart: Evidence-Based Mind-Body Practices to Stress Less and Improve Cardiac Health. Susie is an internationally certified yoga therapist who brings over 40 years of experience utilizing yoga and lifestyle practices to help others heal. In 1983, she founded Yoga Now in Omaha, Nebraska, where she currently teaches classes and directs the annual 200-hour yoga certification program. Susie has developed yoga-based stress management programs for schools, businesses, and hospitals throughout the country. Presently, Susie is a national senior trainer of stress management for the prestigious Ornish Lifestyle Medicine Program for reversing heart disease. Susie has contributed over 150 articles to the online publication Ornish Living Magazine. You can find out more about Susie at her website, yourcenteredheart.com. She's also on Facebook and Instagram at The Centered Heart. Welcome to the Yoga Hour, Susie Amendola. I'm really delighted you could join me today to discuss your book.
Well, thank you so much, Laurel. It's just an honor and a privilege to be here.
So before we begin our dialogue about yoga and heart health, let's begin with some present moment awareness, a yoga moment of being right here and right now. So let's begin by just bringing our attention to our body, just feeling our body in space, whatever we're doing. And in particular, paying attention to the surfaces that support our weight. How much of our weight is supported in a chair if we're sitting, or if we're walking, we can feel the transfer of our weight from foot to foot as we move. And now let's turn our attention to the breath, just noticing as we take a fully conscious breath on the next inhale and exhale. On the next inhale, feeling the cool air in the nostrils. On the exhale, feeling how that temperature is now warmer as the air passes out through our nose. And then just staying right there with our breath, noticing each inhale and each exhale. Here is something to contemplate, a quote from Yogacharya Ellen Grace O'Brien, the founder and spiritual director of this podcast. This is from her book, Living for the Sake of the Soul. We can use our will to direct our thoughts in positive ways that are life and energy enhancing. Our persistent thoughts affect our emotions, overall well-being, and energy levels. Use your thoughts to connect with the divine life and power within and around you. Affirm from that perspective that you are strong, vital, energetic, and enthusiastic. This will energize the body, lift your mood, and help you to be mentally clear. Thoughts may seem insignificant, but they are not. They are building blocks of power, subtle edifices of our present and future experience. Use your thoughts to connect with the divine life and power within and around you. Affirm from that perspective that you are strong, vital, energetic, and enthusiastic. This will energize the body, lift your mood, and help you to be mentally clear. Om. Once again, Susie Amendola, welcome to the Yoga Hour. As I said, I'm delighted that you could join me to discuss heart health and yoga. And as I always say in the beginning of this program, here at the Yoga Hour, we talk about yoga in all its depth and breadth. As you and I are aware, yoga is much more than the physical exercise with which so many people are familiar. It's an ancient philosophical system that includes the health of the mind and spirit, as well as the body. Yoga itself, the word yoga is a Sanskrit word that means union, wholeness, or oneness. One of the things I like about that word is that it's both the goal, union, wholeness, and oneness, but it's also a path to that goal. It's both the goal and a path. You have been practicing yoga for many years, and in your book, you describe how you came to the practice and teaching of yoga, and it was in your teens. So would you share that story briefly with our listeners of how you came to the yoga path?
Well, thank you, Laurel. I just first want to say thank you so much for that beautiful centering practice and that quote. That was really inspiring. So I really appreciate that. I did come to yoga very young. I was 15 years old and living a pretty, just a really sort of normal, happy life. And I went to a party and smoked marijuana once, and I completely came unglued. And from that day forward, I was in a sort of state of panic and anxiety that was so devastating for me. I wasn't able to leave my house. I couldn't talk about it because it was in the 70s. And back then, you know, no one talked about their anxiety back then. Nobody even knew it was a thing. It was either you were mentally ill and in shock treatment, electroshock treatment, or you didn't talk about your mental health. And so I lived in kind of a dark place for a long time. I felt depressed and anxious. I couldn't sleep. I couldn't eat. It was really devastating. And luckily, my mother, who had had 5 children in 6 years, and all of us were in high school at the time, or most of us, I think, she was feeling her own stress. And she had found a local yoga class that was connected to a yoga ashram. And she took me to the ashram one day to take a class. And my life changed in that moment so dramatically that I felt like I needed to dedicate my life to yoga. I mean, I had a feeling of freedom from that anxiety that I hadn't had in maybe a year. And so it led me to a yoga ashram to live at their ashram in Pennsylvania. And I stayed there for several years and studied and practiced and studied Ayurveda and cooked in the Ayurvedic kitchen and did all those things. And then we left and we moved to Nebraska, and it felt so lonely to be in Nebraska. So I needed to start a yoga center so that I could feel the camaraderie and the sense of community that I had had. So that was what led me to start the yoga center.
Oh, that's great. That's actually a very powerful story, you know, of this anxiety that you were coping with, and how even just from one class, you recognize that there was something very powerful about the practice of yoga that led you basically, you know, on this path that you've been on for all the subsequent years. I wanted to ask about the title of the book, actually. I'm curious about how you ended up choosing the centered heart. I mean, it's a beautiful term, the centered heart. So why did you decide to choose this as the book title?
I'm so glad you asked that. I didn't choose it originally. I chose the title Stress Less. It had a couple titles, but the working title was Stress Less. And when the book found its way to the editor, we had sold the book with that title, and the editor that picked it up with that title really loved that title. But then she moved on to another company and the book sat for a while. And when the new editor picked it up, she said, "Oh, no, 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 this can't be the title of the book. This is really harsh. And your book is so soft and gentle and open. And it's about heart. And This says nothing about that. And I was so upset because I had bought a URL, changed all my social media. And so I was really excited about that other title. Well, when she refused to budge, I got busy with my husband and started thinking of other titles. And it just came out of me. And when I heard it, I didn't really recognize how wonderful the title was, but I thought, this is it. This is the title. She had given me some titles that I thought sounded like, you know, the happy heart or something. And I thought that won't work. So we came up with the centered heart. And really what I, you know, what I feel like it does is it kind of changes when you say it, it kind of changes something inside of you. And I thought to myself, oh, what a brilliant idea to switch the title. Because if it were still stressless, I would have to be saying the word stress all the time, stressless, stressless. And I thought, even that makes me stressed to have to say that and to read it and see it. And so in some ways, the word, the title, the centered heart is like a directive. It's like saying center in your heart. Mm-hmm. And so that's how we came to find it. And so thank you for noticing that.
No, I actually love the title, and I think it really says something. And it also draws on what we're going to talk about next, which is there's so much scientific evidence because of the Dean Ornish program. And, you know, you were involved with that from very, very early on. And because of the weight of scientific evidence that's behind that, approach, which includes many of these yoga tools that we're going to be talking about, it has actually become kind of the standard of care, really, of heart health, at least in the United States, and I imagine, you know, even around the world. So if you just said stress less, I think it would really, I kind of agree with the editor of, you know, that you would miss this connection with the heart, which is so vital. I mean, you and I both know that yoga is something that improves our health generally, no matter what is going on. But the evidence behind the cardiovascular effects of yoga as being so beneficial is really remarkable. So let's turn to that right now. Dr. Dean Ornish is a well-known physician and researcher. He's the founder of the Preventive Medicine Research Institute and is an advocate for using diet and lifestyle changes to treat and prevent heart disease. And as I mentioned, his research is now foundational in the care of people with heart disease. Your work in healing with yoga began with your work with him. So how did you get involved with Dr. Dean Ornish and with the Ornish program?
Well, I had never heard of him. And in 1992, I got a call from his team in California, and they said they needed a yoga teacher for a new study they were doing with Mutual of Omaha, which is an insurance company. And it was going to be a multi-center lifestyle trial for reversing heart disease without drugs or surgery. And it was going to be delivered in a local hospital. And when I heard the word hospital, immediately I said no to the request. Yeah. And, you know, I just couldn't see myself working in a hospital teaching yoga. But because it was Omaha and there weren't many yoga teachers, they had someone else call me a couple weeks later. And this time it was a lovely woman from the Integral Yoga Ashram. And she had been a Swami at the ashram. People may know her. She has lots of books out. Her name is Nischala Devi. And she called me and she said, you know, this is such a great program and we really need you. And it's going to be the first time yoga is going to be used as an intervention in a hospital setting. And she said, and I was a Swami at the ashram. And as soon as she said that, I said, I'll do it. I was convinced and I got excited. And I also felt, you know, Laurel, that it was like, it was my Dharma. You know, I had healed myself with these practices and I had many family members, my father included, who had heart disease. My Italian family was just riddled with heart disease. So I took up the challenge and I was so glad. I did, changed my life forever, but I really felt like it was mine to do.
Yeah. That's such a good feeling, isn't it? When you find that work, you know, so rewarding. So what was the, there are many listeners probably who aren't familiar with the Ornish, you know, program. So I wanted you to talk just a little bit about what was the original study design and then what was your role within that?
Well, it was a 4-hour program that was to be delivered 2 times a week. And it included the lifestyle changes of diet, which was a low fat vegetarian diet, exercise, which was moderate exercise, group support, which was talking about your feelings in a group, and stress management. And the stress management was really all of the practices from yoga, because Dr. Ornish himself was a student of Swami Satchidananda from Integral Yoga. And so he really, the program is designed a lot like ashram life. You know, you go outside and you exercise and you talk about your feelings with people around you, and you eat a vegetarian clean diet and you do your practices. So it was really, very familiar, for me. And it included, the protocol included postures, which were gentle movements, relaxation, breathing, meditation, and imagery. And of course, in my book, I've added pieces to that, because I felt over the years that there were more important areas too, like compassion and a connection to nature. But that was the program that we delivered.
Mm-hmm. And again, for listeners who may not be familiar with, what the study found, what were some of the outcomes that were demonstrated for people with heart disease? So these are people, we should say, of like who was in the study. These are people who had already had been diagnosed with significant heart disease.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we had hoped that the program would be for prevention, but really the insurance was really covering people that had gone through some kind of a event or that had some risk factors. And then, this was the program that they would be in. And first of all, the program itself saved Mutual of Omaha $30,000 per patient in the first year in insurance costs.
That's amazing.
Amazing. And also, we were seeing people cutting back on their medicines within the first month. So people were cutting back a lot of diabetics, because a lot of people had comorbidities. They were diabetic. A lot of diabetics were cutting back on their insulin really soon into the program. Others were coming off blood pressure medicines. So, people who couldn't walk across the room without getting breathless were now hiking after a few months in the program. And one thing that stood out so remarkably, as if those things aren't remarkable enough, we had a person that came into the program. His doctor put him in the program because he was on the heart transplant list and they didn't know what to do with him while he was waiting for a heart. So he did the program. And within, I think it was really like 6 weeks to 8 weeks, he came off the heart transplant list. And that alone was fascinating to me. And subsequently, many people had come off the heart transplant list who were in programs throughout the country. So it became more the norm. But we saw so many things. And as you know, as a yoga teacher, I see a lot of things that seem remarkable, but none of them like this, like where they could be tested, right? Where you could see, hey, we're going to cut back your medicine, that people were being followed in that way. So for me, that was really such an eye opener.
Mm-hmm. And validating, yoga as an important part of this multi-pronged approach to cardiac disease. Stress itself is a huge contributor to disease in our Western world. You quote a statistic in the book from the CDC that says 75 to 90% of all doctor visits are for stress-related ailments and complaints. And as I was a primary care physician, a general internist when I was practicing medicine, I've been retired for several years now, but I certainly saw this in all my years of practice, so much stress-related, so many symptoms, so much, illness, malaise that was related to stress. And as I thought about this, to me, one of the main problems with our with stress in today's world is that when the stress response was developed, thousands of years ago, who knows how many thousands, even maybe tens of thousands of years ago, as humans, developed our bodies, it was, for example, there was a something on the ground and it could have been a stick or it could have been a snake, right? And so your body goes into this, response, but pretty soon you figure out either if it's a stick, you're like, okay, I can relax, or if it's a snake, it's like, well, you've already, your body's ready, the stress response is considered the fight, flight, or flee response. So anyway, your body was ready, but then it would pass, right? And the rest of your day would not have anything to do, with the stress of that moment. Whereas stress in today's world, stress to me seems more continuous. There are many people now working from home, which kind of erases the boundaries between our work life and our home life. There's a propensity for companies for there's expectations then of people to, you know, be in their business role, you know, 24/7. I've seen, you know, people need to respond, you know, say on a weekend, oh, I need to respond to this text right now. You know, it's like, well, it didn't used to be that way. And of course it's culturally rewarded, you know, that kind of behavior. So multitasking, which I think is inherently stressful in itself. You're trying to do, you know, too many things at once, and then always looking busy. These are things that, you know, get you some points, you know, in today's business world. So given that that's the world that we live in now, and you're working with clients and trying to convince them that this is something that they need to pay attention to, you know, and to do something about, how do you explain to clients the importance of prioritizing stress management in their life?
Yeah. You know, and another thing I heard just recently is about 3/4 of adults are saying that they experience more stress this year than last year. So our stress levels are just growing every year. One of the things I say to people is, you know, if you try to take swimming lessons when you're drowning, it won't work. But doing these practices daily keep you from drowning in your stress.
Yeah.
Another thing I tell participants that come into our program is that the people in our program who did more stress management showed more reversal of their disease. And that was really not true. If they did more exercise, they didn't show more reversal of their disease. It was really these practices, these yogic practices that did that. And I also talk about really the importance of not trying to squeeze it all into your life, but to let your life really organize around your stress management practices. Mm-hmm. So when we put it first in our life, then, you know, we don't have to work at it. You know, it becomes part of like brushing our teeth. You know, if we're doing it and letting everything organize around it, then it's easier for us. Mm-hmm. We tend to give so much time and attention to what we eat and how we eat and, you know, the foods we eat, and then to our exercise programs. Everybody's talking about being at the gym and walking here and going there. But I rarely hear anybody talk about stress management. And when they do, they'll say things like, oh, I don't need stress management. You know, my knitting is my stress management, or my bird watching, or my walking is my stress management, or my drinking, you know, is my stress management. And while those things may be helpful, they may help you sort of mitigate stress in the moment, they don't retrain the nervous system. They don't build nervous system resilience. Mm-hmm. So I think that's the thing that I get asked a lot of times, you know, is, can I just, you know, bird watch for my stress management? And I'm like, well, you can do that because it's fun and it feels good. But you really need some kind of a training program that helps flip that switch from the sympathetic nervous system, what you talked about, you know, seeing that stick as a snake, to the parasympathetic response, that sort of rest and digest and relaxation response. Mm-hmm. And that's the, you know, that's the nervous system. When we're in the parasympathetic nervous system, that's when we can heal. We don't heal when we're in that sympathetic response, that fight or flight response.
Mm-hmm. And of course, so many yoga practices are really built, you know, to enhance that, to enhance. And I love that term that you use, the nervous system resilience. Mm-hmm. I think that's super important. Mm-hmm. You write in the book, studies are now revealing that somatic therapies, which are defined as therapies that target the mind and body, reduce stress and stress-related illness. The word somatic comes from the root soma, meaning of the body, and these practices serve to bring you into a relationship with your own body. When we experience stress or trauma, we tend to move out of the body so we don't have to feel the discomfort. So clearly, yoga is one of the somatic therapies that you describe in the book. Yoga involves many practices that you've already mentioned, in addition to the postural yoga or hatha yoga, like breathing exercises, which you include in the book, pranayama, and also meditation. So can you say this a little bit more about, you know, somatic therapies? Do you consider all, because it's actually an interesting term, because soma means of the body, and yet really what we're talking about is mind and body in the same place. And I guess I should also mention, of course, yoga is not the only somatic therapy. Recently had an episode on Tai Chi. So Tai Chi is another somatic, you know, approach. Anyway, I was just wondering your thoughts about these other practices of yoga and whether those also count as somatic therapies.
I think you answered it. I really do think of them. You know, I think if you get down to brass tacks with people, some somatic therapists would say it does mean of the body, and they are body practices. But I really see that there's an integration that has to happen for us to heal, a body-mind integration. And that's exactly what the other practices help us do. Mm-hmm. So I think in the context of practice doing postures and breathing and relaxation and meditation, that all together becomes a somatic practice because it helps us to integrate. It helps us to call back those fragmented and segmented pieces of ourselves that we lose in our struggles or our traumas.
Mm-hmm. No, I think that's absolutely true. To me, it's having the mind and body in the same place at the same time, you know, really together. And as you point out, it's actually very, very easy for them to become separated when we experience stress or trauma. We try and get out of the body so we don't have to feel that discomfort. And then, you know, we're kind of stuck in a place that doesn't actually resolve, you know, doesn't get a chance to resolve that.
Yeah. And I, you know, that's such a good point. And I see that over and over again, when I work with patients and participants in the Ornish program, that they're, you know, they're traumatized. Oftentimes their traumas are what lead to their heart disease. And sometimes their trauma is heart disease and the way they're treated and the interventions that they've had to go through. So many of them have left their bodies. So it really does. And maybe they've left their bodies long before. So I think that, you know, these practices are a coming back, you know, and really one of the first practices I always teach in the program is this practice called centering. And it really is reclaiming your body, like going in and feeling and sensing your body. Now, in the later relaxation, I don't talk about it as your body. I talk about it as the body. But in the beginning, it's like we have to claim ourselves first, right? Before we can kind of move into a more spiritual realm. Mm-hmm. So there is a lot of that reclaiming that happens in those practices of postures and breathing and relaxation and meditation and imagery.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I know you've already said a little bit about this, but I want to touch back on what does scientific studies say about the effect of yoga on cardiovascular health? And we should say, if it hasn't already been clear, that there actually is significant evidence for reversal of cardiac blockages. There is actually significant scientific evidence, you know, that actually can happen, which up until the Ornish program actually it was doubtful. I mean, people the Western medical community really didn't know that that was possible. And that's something that was demonstrated. So did you want to say more about that?
Yeah, there's a couple things that brings up for me. And one is that when I started working in the Ornish program, there was no research about yoga and heart disease. Right. There was no research on any of the techniques. I would try to get it. In fact, when we tried to get Medicare coverage, they wanted research. And really the only research I could find was Indian research. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times that wasn't acceptable to the American mind. And so, and even our participants always wanted research, you know, so we had to really talk a lot about, you know, you're doing your own research, you do this, and then you tell us, do you feel better? And I think that that's a very yogic approach. And yet at the same time, it's really interesting because when people say they feel better, their numbers usually correspond to that. Right. So I saw that over and over again. Now, some of the research that I've seen lately, you know, and I've been scouring through because now, you know, with the internet and everything, there's so much research on every one of the techniques in yoga. But right now, some of the studies are showing that the pharmacological treatments alone may not be a cure for CVD at all, since many of those treatments have really harmful side effects, and they're really not even as effective as they thought they were. So the comprehensive reviews are really suggesting that yoga reduces the risk profile by decreasing the fight or flight response and by enhancing the relaxation response. So my friend, Dr. Ananda Bhavanani, who is a student, he's a, excuse me, a, the head of the Gitananda Ashram in India. He publishes a lot of research. And, you know, he had a study where he looked at, I think, 1,800 people, and it showed that there was a healthy reduction in heart rate, blood pressure, and cardiac risk factors following just one single yoga session. Oh. Just one session. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when we would work in this, when I was working in the program with patients and participants, our nursing staff would come in after relaxation and take blood pressures. And in almost every single person, blood pressure lowered instantly after relaxation. And then the nurses got kind of savvy about the breathing practices. And so when people would come in with high blood pressure, they would actually teach them alternate nostril breathing and their blood pressure would come down. So, you know, we saw so much, and now research, you know, science is really backing everything that we saw.
As a reminder to our listeners, today on the Yoga Hour, my guest is Susie Amendola, and we are discussing her book, The Centered Heart, Evidence-Based Mind-Body Practices to Stress Less and Improve Cardiac Health. You can find out more about Susie Amendola at her website, yourcenteredheart.com. She's also on Facebook and Instagram at The Centered Heart. We will publish these links along with this program on our website at theyogahour.com. We welcome your comments and questions. You can contact us via that website, theyogahour.com, where you can also sign up for our mailing list. So, Susie, your book is rich with many practices from yoga and Ayurveda that support and improve our heart health. I wanted to take some time to touch in a little bit more deeply on some of those practices. In your book, you offer instructions on gentle yoga postures that support our health and wellness. As we said earlier, the entirety of yoga is much greater than just the postures, but the postures are really supportive of health in general and heart health. Often people who have cardiac disease are older and have been for years looking at the images on the front of yoga magazines that they might see in the grocery store checkout line. And invariably, those pictures are also very thin people in skimpy clothing, and they're doing these impossible looking pretzel poses, which give the, you know, the person who's standing in the checkout line the idea that yoga is not for them. But gentle yoga postures actually are available to everyone. You don't have to be a gymnast. You don't have to be thin. You don't have to be wearing skimpy clothing. gentle yoga stretches and poses are a healthy form of exercise that can be performed by anyone. And I really appreciate that in the book, in the photos that you have of the poses, because you do have a section on the yoga poses themselves, you show the option of sitting in a chair, so doing chair yoga, as well as being on the floor on a yoga mat. In the book, you say that one way to tune into our own inner wisdom is through the practice of this postural yoga. Would you say more about this? How do postures help us listen? And what are we listening for?
Well, the body is always trying to alert us. In fact, so many of my heart participants have said to me, they'll whisper it to me, you know, I knew there was something wrong. I just didn't listen. And in Ayurveda, they say disease knocks three times. And if you don't listen, it takes you. So doing the gentle movements, they help you listen. So you start to notice things that seem different or unusual, or you can start to make changes to accommodate what the body might be telling you about yourself. Sometimes I even ask participants to go inside and ask their body what it needs. Ask your heart what it needs, and then just be still and listen. And the heart doesn't always talk in words. Sometimes there is a kind of aha or a felt sense or an image that comes. But most of all, just sort of connecting with your heart, going in and asking your heart, you know, it really strengthens your own intuition, your own inner wisdom, and your own inner knowingness. And I think that's a really important piece, that we really have a lot of agency in our own healing if we just go in and ask and listen. And one of the things that I'll say to people is, even if you don't get an answer, you know, just that asking and listening is so important, because it puts us in touch with our intuition. And we might find ourselves, you know, a day or two later in the right place at the right time with the right people in the right circumstances. Or we may just feel ourselves in a kind of flow. You know how everything kind of opens up when we flow with this kind of ease and grace? That really comes when we're connected to our own intuition and our own inner knowingness.
That's so interesting that you mentioned that people say, I knew that there was something that I should be paying attention to, but I just wasn't listening, or maybe more importantly, I wasn't acting, on that information. And I think that's something that we certainly all we can all fall into. But I love the idea, of using that time to tune in and listen more deeply into these inner messages that we're receiving.
Yeah, I tell the story in my book of my daughter when she was young. She was in grade school and she said she would come home with these terrible headaches. And I said to her, Gracie, is there some way that you're sitting or something you're doing that's causing these headaches? Like maybe you're holding your head or you're squinting. And she said to me, and she must have been like 8 years old, maybe nine. She said, Mom, I'm not paying attention to my body. I'm listening to the teacher. That's how you learn. And I thought to myself, oh my gosh, that's what our message is from when we're really young, that it's not about what's happening inside, it's what's happening outside. So this kind of redirecting people to really listen is really important. We, so many of us have just neglected, our bodies and we don't listen.
You write in the book, the body reflects the habitual, not the occasional. I think that's such an important, that's such an important point. I'm going to read it again. The body reflects the habitual, not the occasional. And you go on, what we do, how we think, and how we move are all subject to our habits. This, to me, is one of the keys to why yoga, in particular, postural yoga, could be any of the yoga practices, but really postural yoga is so helpful to people. I am aware of my own characteristic patterns of tension that I hold in my body, but everybody has these. Everybody does. And if you've ever been in a yoga class where they're giving you cues to pay attention to, do you have any tension in your jaw? Do you have anything in your shoulders? I tell you, for me, I almost always have something in my jaw, and in my shoulders, and particularly my right shoulder is one that I really hold this tension in. So when I That's kind of my body, like my general body posture. That's just it, that I come with that, tension, which, I could go into like where I think that came from because I've done a little work. But anyway, it's what I have now. It's the embodied life that I've lived. And so when I go and do other forms of exercise, like if I walk, that's the body that I'm walking with. And so I'm staying in that same characteristic tension pattern that I have. So for me, that's one of the real benefits of yoga is it puts your body into these different poses that are not your typical pose, and it encourages you to pay attention to any of the held tension that you have, and it offers you a different way to hold your body and become again more aware of this tension and to release it. So yoga, we haven't mentioned so far, but in addition to the cardiovascular health, there's a huge number of diseases and health issues now that yoga has been proven to be beneficial for. I mean, the list is like super long. Would you say more about how the gentle movement of yoga postures can support us in having a healthy body, mind, and spirit overall?
I just love listening to you, Laurel. Just that story was so wonderful, and everyone can relate to that. We all carry these patterns of tension. The gentle movements really help us shape and retrain old patterns that aren't working for us anymore. So it's like when you place a stone in a river. If you keep placing a stone in the same place over and over and over, eventually the direction of the river will change, right? And for better or for worse. So if we change the patterns of movement over and over, our energy changes direction. And this is how new pathways are formed and how we begin to reshape ourselves. So in the case of heart disease, doing poses like the cobra every day, over and over, that movement of the shoulders coming back and the chest expanding, it opens up the flow of blood and energy to the heart. I can't tell you how many heart patients I've hugged and their shoulders are like this. There's nothing coming or going. That flow isn't going to happen. And really, our arms carry the action of our heart out into the world. They let us give and receive love. And so if we're blocking it, our shoulder wings can kind of block that. It doesn't let that flow happen. I too have shoulder stuff sometimes. That's really inherent with working on the computer. But when you retrain that pattern, if you go back and retrain it, you can open up the flow. And so when our bodies are flowing with greater ease, it affects our mind. And when our mind is at ease, it ultimately affects our spirit.
So now I want to turn to breath, because in yoga, pretty much any yoga class that you go to, they're going to talk about how you breathe and moving your breathing to coordinate with your movement. So breath is a really important tool and is an outer manifestation of our life force, our vitality, or as it's described in yoga, our prana. Different breath techniques are taught to quiet the mind for meditation. There's all kinds of effects that you can trigger. You've already mentioned this alternate nostril breathing and its effect on balancing the two sides of the body and bringing everything more into harmony, and can, you know, reduce our blood pressure. So let's talk about that breath and the importance of breath in stress reduction. Mm-hmm. What would you add to that?
Well, breath affects how we breathe, affects how we think and feel, and how we think and feel affects how we breathe. So if you change your breathing, it affects the mind. And if you change how you're thinking, it changes your breath. So a perfect example is an anxiety attack. So mm-hmm. when we're anxious, our breath gets really short and shallow. But if we change our breathing, the anxiety lifts, right? So, you know, our breath is really our connection to our nervous system. So our inhale breath stimulates the sympathetic nervous system, and the exhale breath stimulates the parasympathetic nervous system. So just spending a little more time with the exhale breath helps to calm the nervous system and upregulate the relaxation response. And my teacher used to say, you know, my teacher used to say, there's a breath pattern that precedes every disease. And in the case of heart disease, one of those patterns is really the unconscious retention of breath. Oftentimes you'll see patients holding their breath on the inhale, unconsciously holding it. And this, you know, leads to pressure in the heart. So I think that there's a lot of ways that breath, you know, really can change, you know, our physical health and well-being, and particularly affects our mindset and our nervous system.
Mm-hmm. That was one of the things, in addition to my Western medical training, I've also gotten some training in yoga therapy. And I was just so fascinated with the association with the exhale and with the parasympathetic, that if we can just extend the length of our exhale, it's the quickest way to get us into that, that you were mentioning, the parasympathetic system, or people may be more familiar with the term, the relaxation response, or the rest and digest, you know, portion. You've heard about the, you know, the stress response as being the fight or flight. More recently, I've seen it fight, flight, or freeze. But for the relaxation response, just extending the exhale, it's fascinating, isn't it? And when I think about it, of course, there's these powerful ways that the breath is associated with the body, because there's never been a time throughout the body's evolution when we didn't breathe. I mean, it's been there the whole time, right? So of course it has these powerful, you know, these powerful impacts. You offer several breathing techniques in chapter four. There's many, and I wish we had a chance to talk about more, but we haven't actually talked about this humming breath or bee's breath, Brahmari breath, in the past here on the show. And I thought that that's a little something that maybe we could talk listeners through that could be useful in reducing stress. For, would you say, first comment about the breath itself and the effects of the breath, and then give a little instruction on for listeners to how to do the breath?
Well, Brahmari is, you know, it's just what we were just talking about. It really allows you to spend more time with your exhale breath, because you're just buzzing. And it's a breathing practice that's really soothing. In fact, you know, when my children were little, both of them did this kind of Brahmari thing before they would go to sleep. They would buzz. They'd go, and you'd bounce them. They'd go, And I thought, wow, that's so interesting. It really does help sort of, you know, upregulate that parasympathetic nervous system so that you can just rest. And so it's just that, it's a buzzing sound. And when you make it, some people call it the humming breath, but humming kind of implies singing. And it's not singing, it doesn't sound pretty. It's got like a bee sound to it, a buzzing sound. So maybe we could just all do it together. We'll do a few rounds of it. And it's done by creating a little bit of a vibration. So as you're buzzing, it sounds like this.
I think it's the computer's, you know, editing out that sound, but maybe do it just a little bit louder.
I'll do it louder and see. I had this problem when I was teaching breathing on Zoom once that nobody could hear Brahmari.
Yeah. There we go. Yeah. I've also heard it described actually literally as a buzz, and so literally adding the Z sound to it.
Wow. Yeah, I haven't done it that way. That's awesome.
But both of them, as we've just been talking about, kind of because they're done on the exhale. And so you're trying to keep that sound going. So it is a way of just increasing the exhale relative to the inhale. So let's do another one, and I'll do the Z, see if it picks up
Inhale slowly.
the That's so funny. I feel it even just that one breath. I feel calmer now. I feel like my tone of my voice also deepened a little
I
bit.
feel better too. My shoulders just kind of dropped away from my ears.
Yeah. So
Yeah.
that's something listeners can play with when you're kind of stressed out. Could take a little humming breath or buzzing breath and see if that will help center you. It's great because it doesn't require any, you don't have to purchase any equipment. You can just sit at your desk and do it, or take a little break, stand up, roll your shoulders a couple times and do a couple of those breaths. I think it'll be beneficial for you. So on the program, we do talk about meditation because it is something that we feel is just so critical. Those of us who meditate regularly have experienced the many physical, mental, and spiritual benefits of meditation. There are many scientific studies on the physical benefits of meditation, which have shown that stress hormones like cortisol are reduced with meditation. And of course, blood pressure decreases because of the relaxation of the blood vessel wall. So there's actual, as I mentioned, scientific evidence about these health benefits. What else would you say about how meditation works for stress reduction and cardiovascular health?
Well, not only does meditation lower heart rate and blood pressure, but it also gives us the ability to bear witness to our thoughts. And as we do that, our mind starts to unwind and it just starts to lose its hold over us. So we start to create space to make different choices, space to just spread out. So, and another thing that happens is it also helps to improve sleep. And if we aren't sleeping well, we can't heal. So there's a lot of research on sleep, and meditation really does change our sleep. It really allows us to sleep deeper. So many people go to sleep while they're sort of they've overdone it and they don't rest before they sleep, and then they spend all of their sleep sort of fretting and ruminating. And so when you do meditation before you sleep, it sort of takes all that edge off and it allows your sleep to be deeper and more healing.
I love the way that you just described that, creating a space, because literally that's my experience. When a meditation practice is really steady and strong, it's like there's a space around me. And so things can happen in my life that might be upsetting, even something little like getting cut off in traffic or something like that. And then there's this space that I feel like I can choose how I want to respond to that. Whereas if I don't have that, something happens and I just like immediately respond. It's kind of like the reflex when the doctor hits your knee with the hammer, that just instinctive. You're like cursing at that person that cut you off in traffic, instead of just saying, oh, they're having a day where, for some whatever reason they feel like they need to be ahead of me in traffic. I don't know. It's just a different way of looking at it. And I really appreciate those benefits of meditation and the way that it allows me to tune into this underlying oneness. And I don't No one has like fantastic meditation experiences, I think, every single time they meditate, but lots of times I'm able to get into that place where I just feel that sense of connection. And I feel like that in itself is very healing for people.
Yes, absolutely. And when you were talking about traffic and, people cutting you off, I mean, that's how I tell that I'm not doing enough meditation. If I get upset when somebody cuts me off, I
Sure.
usually say to them, after I curse, I usually say to myself, got to do a little more meditation, Susie, because that shouldn't be bothering you.
Right. Or particularly in our relationship with other people that we live with, you know, if they're doing something and it's really like getting to you, it's like, oh, I think I need a little bit, I need to like up my meditation practice, because getting angry is not going to be the beneficial response to this person that I love and that I live with, who may be annoying me in this moment. So you offer lots of different meditation techniques in the book. Are there any specific meditation techniques that are better than others for heart health in particular?
I love that you asked this because I always say to people, the best technique is the one that you'll do.
Yes, absolutely.
That's why I include all different techniques, because not every technique of meditation works for everyone, especially in the world of trauma. So with heart patients, they may also, be experiencing other things, like some of them have COPD. If you ask someone with COPD to meditate on their breath, it might create tremendous anxiety for them. And so they might need, or someone with asthma, same thing. So they might need to do a meditation on a candle flame, right? Or some other kind of meditation. Or someone who's afraid of going inward or sitting quietly may not be able to sit still at all for meditation. So walking meditation might be good for them. Someone who's trying to get in touch with their feelings, and a lot of times, heart disease can be something that we feel walled off from our feelings, and we have to start to bring ourselves back to being in touch with them. So, choosing meditation on a feeling is also really good. So anything where we bring the mind back to a point of focus is an entrance into the experience of meditation.
I think that's great, and absolutely agree with your statement that the best meditation technique for you is the one that you'll do. I think that's great. It's very common for people, especially that who haven't been meditating in the past, to say that their minds are too busy to sit and meditate. So how do you approach that with patients?
Well, the question I always get too, Laurel, is patients will say, I can't meditate because I can't make my mind blank. And they'll say it with such a pained look. And I'll say, well, that's good, because if your mind was blank, you wouldn't be alive. So it's really, the best we can hope for is to get some space from the constant movement of the mind. So for people that have a difficult time and they say their mind is too busy, really, if you do postures and breathing and relaxation, and imagery, that leads you right, it delivers you right to the doorstep of meditation, so that meditation really comes naturally. The mind becomes very quiet when you put those practices together. But if you don't do those practices first, I often suggest that people go out and take a walk or get some exercise right before, so that they kind of let the mind kind of run its, do its gymnastics. And then they come back and the mind is a little more willing to settle down.
That's good advice.
In the end, meditation itself is what calms the mind, so it doesn't feel busy. So, it's just making the effort to sit even when the mind is busy. To just take the effort, do it anyway, sit there and see how you feel. And over time, it gets easier, and the mind is less likely to be, in that constant state of running, when you practice regularly.
I think expectations too, like you mentioned, that if your expectation is that your mind is going to be completely still, that in itself is a, can cause more churning of the mind, because, then it's pretty much inevitable, I think. When we first sit to meditate, we become distracted, like we're focusing, whatever your focal point is, it might be, as you mentioned, the breath, it might be a candle flame, whatever it is. Then all of a sudden you realize you're thinking about something that happened earlier that day. If you then give yourself a hard time, that's what you always do. That's what always happens. I mean, that is just more noise. That's just more, explosion in the mind. And so, the idea, I love the image that, has been used by many teachers of meditation that I've had, which is feeling like, like they're like imagining the clear blue sky. And if there's a thought or emotion that interferes with your concentration on whatever your focal point is, just see if you can look at it as a cloud that's going across that clear blue sky, that you acknowledge it. It's not that you're fighting it. It's not that you're giving yourself a hard time about it. And then you just come back to the point of focus. And the more that you do that, the better that you get it. I think focus is a skill, just like a muscular skill, just like, you know, if we want to increase our muscle skill, you know, strength, we need to, you know, we need to build that muscle strength. Well, focus is just like that, where you need to build the ability to focus. But as you do, just as you said, it becomes easier the more that you go on, for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you for that.
I wanted to briefly mention the science of Ayurveda. You have an entire chapter entitled Nature Consciousness that describes Ayurveda. I have studied Ayurveda myself, and I think it's really this amazing tool for bringing our bodies into balance by including a lot of information about lifestyle that's really, I think Western medicine is just has nothing to compare to the level of detailed information that there is about how you can balance your constitution in Ayurveda. So can you briefly describe why you think it's important to include and why you include it in your teachings?
Yeah, thank you. I have also been a longtime practitioner of Ayurveda and have had an Ayurvedic physician for many, many years. And as you know, Ayurveda is really the sister science to yoga. And I often hear people say that yoga deals with consciousness and Ayurveda with our material existence. And while I think that's partly true, I think that both of them deal with both in some ways, but I do think that Ayurveda really offers so many practices for managing our physical health. So it's a natural choice, you know, for your yoga therapist to incorporate its teachings, because it is really just made for that. But also, Ayurveda teaches that we're all made up of the five elements. And those elements that exist outside of us also exist inside of us in the form of water, earth, fire, air, and space. So in order to be in balance in our own bodies, we need to find balance with the elements outside of us. We need to live in harmony with the natural world. Mm-hmm. So I really give a lot of practices. You know, I talk about the dosha theory in the book, but I also give simple practices for people who don't want to get into, you know, understanding the doshas, just in how you can align with nature in each of the elements. Like, for example, you know, to align with the air element, you might watch bees around flowers and how they sort of buzz around them, or you might bird watch or even fly a kite. And to get more connected to the element of space, you might look up and stargaze, you know, or, you know, there's so many different practices that we can incorporate into just our daily existence that will help us really recognize that we are part of something much bigger. Mm-hmm. And that feeling of being part of something bigger, that unification, that feeling of union, is really what it's all about. And it's really what helps us heal.
Mm. That was such a great description. And I love your ideas of, you know, experiencing the elements through these just basic, you know, basic practices. There's so much more in your book that I would have loved to have time to talk about today, but we've come to the end of our session. In closing, what words of encouragement or inspiration would you like to share with our listeners?
Well, I think I'd like to just impress upon those who are listening that we have a lot more agency in our own healing than we may have imagined. So I really encourage everyone to ground into that, mm-hmm. that when we do these daily stress management practices, they help us to center in our hearts. And it's there that we connect with our own inner wisdom, our own intuition, and our own inner healer.
Mm. Yeah. Very beautifully said. For our listeners, you've been listening to the Yoga Hour. It's been my pleasure to share this time with you. I'm Dr. Laurel Trujillo, producer and host of the show. My guest today has been Susie Amendola, yoga therapist and instructor, and the author of the book we've been discussing today, The Centered Heart, Evidence-Based Mind-Body Practices to Stress Less and Improve Cardiac Health. You can find out more about Susie Amendola, her book, and her programs and classes at her author website, yourcenteredheart.com. I should also mention her yoga website, doyoganow.com. She's also on Facebook and Instagram at The Centered Heart. Thank you so much, Susie Amendola, for joining me today on the Yoga Hour.
Laurel, it's been such a joy and a privilege and a pleasure. Thank you so much for having me on. Yeah.
For listeners, we hope you'll join us for the many online programs offered by the sponsor of this program, the Center for Spiritual Enlightenment. There's daily online meditation in the morning at 6:30 a.m. Pacific, in the afternoon at 4, and on Monday evenings at 7:30. Again, all those times are Pacific time. There's also a Sunday satsang. Satsang is a Sanskrit word meaning a gathering of truth seekers that happens at 10 a.m. Pacific each Sunday. Another podcast that might be of interest to listeners of this program is the Kriya Yoga Today podcast with Yogacharya Ellen Grace O'Brien that includes some presentations from classes and talks that she has given. You can find out more about this at the Center for Spiritual Enlightenment website, csecenter.org. You can also find the Kriya Yoga Today podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Join us next time on the Yoga Hour when my guest will be Shivani Lucky. Shivani is a longtime Kriya Yoga meditation teacher and senior teacher for the Ananda community. We will be discussing how our bodies and minds have an amazing capacity to heal and thrive due to our life force or prana. The Yoga Hour is a service project of the Center for Spiritual Enlightenment, a meditation center in the Kriya Yoga tradition. Remember, you can subscribe to the Yoga Hour wherever you get your podcasts. And if you're enjoying the show, share it with a friend. Thank you to the Yoga Hour team, founder and spiritual director, Yogacharya Ellen Grace O'Brien, assistant producers, Ann Hayes, Mickey Coronado, Christine Soat, and Lauren Leidinger. I look forward to being with you again. Until then, remember, you carry your own healing and wholeness within you. Share your peace and joy with all you meet. Bye now.